this is Johnny Whitaker, and you're listening to TV Confidential.
Ed Robertson, along with the guest John Burlingame. John Burlingame, the foremost authority on the subject of music for movies and television, and the author of such books as Music for Primetime, A History of American Television and Scoring. John's latest book is called Dreamsville, Everything You Want to Know About Peter Gunn, the classic Private Eye series from the early 1960s that not only put Henry Mancini on the map, but changed the face and the sound of primetime television by introducing jazz as dramatic accompaniment. Dreamsville is thoroughly researched, includes interviews that John conducted over the years with Henry Mancini and Blake Edwards, as well as John Williams, many of the other musicians who accompanied Henry Mancini on the Peter Gunn and later Mr. Lucky recording sessions. Dreamsville also takes you behind the scenes of Mr. Lucky, the Blake Edwards series starring John Vivian and Ross Martin that also featured original music by Henry Mancini. Plus, Dreamsville features the sort of incisive commentary that we come to expect from a book by John Burlingame. Dreamsville, available Bear Manor Media, wherever books are sold. Before we go off topic of the musicians, another name that jumped to mind, another musician that played with Mancini on the Peter Gunn sessions was Shorty Rogers. Now, Shorty Rogers was known for a lot of things. No, he wasn't.
No. Shorty Rogers was integral to what would happen, but he didn't actually play on the Gunn sessions.
Okay.
Can I talk about that?
Go ahead. This is your book.
So what happened was this. Alan Livingston thinks this should be a Peter Gunn album a couple of months before it actually goes on the air. So he calls his colleagues over at RCA Victor, and they think, well, Shorty Rogers is signed to us. Maybe. And Shorty is not only under contract to us, but Shorty's had some pretty big hits. Mm-hmm. Shorty Rogers was a great trumpet player, yes, and flugelhorn player and band leader. And so the initial thought was, let's have Shorty Rogers go in the studio and record this Peter Gunn music. Shorty met with Henry Mancini to talk about this. And Mancini, being a good and dutiful sort of servant at the moment, said, you know, we'd love to have you do this. And Shorty said, no, you should do this. I don't need to do this. This is your music. You know how it should sound. You should be the arranger and the conductor, and you should be the band leader. Mancini said, so basically Mancini left the lunch thinking, Shorty doesn't want to do this. And okay, I guess I can. I'll do this. And that's how the Mancini thing came about. And when the album went to number one, all of a sudden, Henry Mancini was a legitimate, bankable recording artist. And it was because Shorty said, no, you should do this.
Okay, so that also speaks to sort of the generosity of spirit of musicians in general. So
yeah,
they recognize,
that's right.
You know.
Yeah. Listen, those guys, I didn't know that many of them that were active in the 50s and 60s because I came along so much later. I didn't get here until the 80s. But I will say, in addition to John Williams, there are still two guys alive who played on those original 58 to 61 recordings. Dick Nash, the great, great trombonist, and Ronnie Lang, who played flute and saxophone on a lot of those sessions. And I went out to Ronnie's house out in the valley last year to talk to him about this experience. And these are giants.
Yeah.
These are guys whose names I would read on the back of my LPs back in the 60s and 70s. Who is this Ronnie Lang fellow? Well, he couldn't be nicer. He's the most lovely guy, enormously talented, had a career that started in the 50s and went all the way into the 90s, you know. But soft-spoken, funny, now in his 90s, I should add, and as with it as you could imagine. It was such a joy to hang around with these guys and talk to them about the experiences.
We mentioned early in our conversation, this book took you 10 years to do, not because you're slow, but because you're busy. What first inspired you to do this book?
Okay, so I've always loved Peter Gunn, the show. I've always loved Henry Mancini's music from the time I was a kid in the 1960s. So when I moved to L.A. in 86, to my great joy, the discovery that I made was Channel 56 was running Peter Gunn every night in the late 1980s. So thank God I had a VCR, I started taping them.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I just loved the show. I loved the backdrop. I loved the characters. And of course, I loved the music. And I've always been a big jazz fan. So I had a number of other books that were more important for me to write in the 90s and the early 2000s. But I kept coming back to this notion that nobody had ever written a book about Peter Gunn. And I thought, well, shouldn't there be one? And the later it got, well into the 2000s, I thought, you know, people are not remembering the show.
Yeah.
Most of my students at the University of Southern California have never seen it. You know, they've heard of it because they've heard the tune.
Yeah.
They know the theme.
Right.
They've never seen the show. And I thought, well, this would be a labor of love. I really would love to do this. The other thing that was important for me to do when I wrote this book last year was to coincide with the Mancini Centennial.
Mm-hmm.
This year marks the 100th birthday of Henry Mancini. You know, to my, luckily, I got to talk to him in the 80s and the 90s for different projects. But I did get to talk to him quite a lot about Gunn, which was his first great claim to fame, really. And so I did start to think about this back in the 90s and the early 2000s, but I didn't really take it, the idea seriously until I had written a few other books that were important to me.
One of the unsung heroes of this book is a man named Ned Comstock.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
I know who Ned Comstock is. John knows who Ned Comstock is. Anyone who has written books on film and television history would know who Ned is. Ned was one of the go-to people at the USC Film and TV Archives. And Ned helped countless people put the books together that all of us take for granted.
It's so true.
And yeah. I just learned this 2 days ago. We lost Ned.
We did. We lost Ned to cancer a few weeks ago. And it was a huge loss to those of us who are journalists who covered this sort of showbiz historical medium. And I knew Ned dating back to the early 1990s when I first put together a museum exhibit at the Hollywood Bowl about the history of film music. And that's when I first met Ned. Then when I started teaching at USC in the late 90s, I was on campus at least once a week, and I would always visit Ned at the cinema library.
Yeah.
And the lesson that I learned early on, and of course, as you know, Ed, I've not only written a few books, but I've written dozens of liner notes for albums of movie and TV music. The lesson I learned was, no matter what you're working on, even if you think there's no chance that there will be anything at USC in the archives or the library related to what you're doing, tell Ned, because Ned will undoubtedly know something that you ought to know where there is stuff to be looked at that might broaden your knowledge of a subject. Or, I mean, he was uncanny. He was amazing. And we became very close through the years. And it was such a loss to those of us who write about this field.
I did not know Ned as well as you did, but he was helpful when I first put my Maverick book together in 94, 95. I believe I crossed paths with him a few years later when I researched Harry O for Television Chronicles magazine. And I remember talking to him a few years ago while I was in the middle of my FBI book research. And so we have colleagues, all of whom are indebted to the... I mean, he would go, as you just said, he would go the extra mile for you.
And one of the things that I always think about is I had this idea many years ago, and I mentioned it to him. And he said, well, we have this, and we have this, and we have this, and you might be interested in this. And he would call me and say, well, listen, I pulled some stuff for you that you might want to look at, even if there was no project. And he would make copies of things for me, you know, columns that Hal Humphrey had written for the LA Times back in the early 60s or anything that related to the Mancini scores or anything like that. A key element, though, that really, really affected this book was he had, back in his cubbyhole, a book of notations that were made about pilots that were in production in the late 50s and the early 60s. And these notes were, it was always a kind of mysterious thing. Who made these notes? Who was this person who said, well, it was that pilot book was the only clue I had that they shot the pilot for Peter Gunn at Desilu. And it was the only thing that was done at Desilu was the pilot. And it was recorded. The music was recorded at Desilu, which became, in turn, a key for me to talk to the musicians union And I said, can you just check the Desilu recording logs for April and May of 1958? And sure enough, there were the recording dates with the names of the musicians, the date it was recorded, and guess what? The pilot was recorded at Glen Glen Sound, which was the sound component of Desilu Studios. And all of these things mushroomed from the fact that Ned had this book with this pilot information in it, and so much came from that.
Ned Comstock, one of the unsung heroes of Dreamsville, Henry Mancini, Peter Gunn, and music for TV noir John Burlingame's latest book, which you can find through our friends Bear Manor Media as well as Amazon.com.
Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back.
One more item. If you're a fan of Mike Connors, if you're a fan of Mannix, check out Mike Connors, A Life of Integrity in Film and Television, an excellent new book by Bill Taylor that not only tells you everything you want to know about the life and career of Mike Connors, but captures the utter decency of Mike Connors, the person. For all the notoriety he enjoyed because of the phenomenal success of Mannix, Mike Connors was as down-to-earth as one could be. He never forgot where he came from, and he always made everyone feel special, whether they're a fellow actor or ordinary folks like you and me. Mike Connors, A Life of Integrity in Film and Television, available now wherever books are sold through Bear Manor Media, as well as Amazon.com, BarnesNoble.com, and wherever books are sold online.
Hi, this is Melissa Manchester, and you, you lucky people, are listening to TV Confidential.
Before we forget, you mentioned many of your students at USC have only a passing knowledge of Peter Gunn, the show. I'm sure none of them heard of Mr. Lucky.
I can almost guarantee you that that's the case. Unless for some reason they happen to be Mancini fans and have stumbled across the Mr. Lucky albums.
Or unless they're Stephen Bowie.
Well, there's always that too. Yeah, that's right. Who is, by the way, long gone from USC and now in New York and pursuing his TV history blog.
I've never told this story on the air. I first met Stephen. I've never met him face to face, but he came into my life about a year or two after I first released The Fugitive Recaptured. And I got this very detailed letter from this kid named Stephen Bowie. I didn't know he was a kid.
He was really never a kid.
No, he was. That was very evident. But anyway, he wrote a very detailed letter that said what he liked about the book and what he didn't like about the book. You know, it was very. And I remember writing in. I appreciated the criticism. Let's put it that way. And I said, thank you very much. You read my book. About 5 years later. And again, I have this picture in my mind of who Stephen Bowie is. I didn't realize he was a teenager at this time. So he was like way ahead. He was like way ahead of his thinking from a different lifetime. But Stephen Bowie, in a lot of ways, does God's work as far as film and television research is concerned.
No, that's absolutely true. And his his classic TV history blog on the internet is must reading for anyone who has any interest in how television came about in the 1950s and the kind of programming and more to the point, the people who were responsible for some of the great shows that we remember in that golden era of the 50s and 60s.
One of whom, it came to be in the golden era of the 50s and 60s, Mr. Lucky. The backstory is almost as interesting as that of Peter Gunn itself. Now, this happens a lot. When you get one hit show on the air, the network, the studio, whoever you're dealing with says, okay, Blake, do you have something else in you?
Yeah.
And long story short, he comes up with, he didn't create Mr. Lucky. He adapted it from a movie Cary Grant had made in the 1940s.
Yeah, that's right. Cary Grant made a movie called Mr. Lucky, and it was for RKO. But by 1959, when Peter Gunn had become a huge hit and the networks were clamoring for another Blake Edwards show, RKO was out of business. And so Blake was able to acquire the rights to the magazine story that inspired the movie and therefore take off from there. And so he, and it's fascinating to me that Mr. Lucky went on the air in October of 59. It didn't even have a script until August of 59. The, you know, CBS bought the concept.
It didn't have Ross Martin until 2 days before it started production.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And when you think about that today, it's sort of, the mind is boggled, I think, you know, at how fast this came about. So he had two scripts written. And anyway, I guess we should talk about the concept.
Yeah.
Which was this this very debonair gambler, whose name we only know of as Mr. Lucky, is running a casino down in some banana republic somewhere, and he finds that he has to leave the country in a hurry, comes back to America, and in an amazing gambling feat, acquires a big boat, which he puts 3 miles beyond the statutory limits of Los Angeles, and so he runs a casino,
yeah,
of an ocean-going casino, as it were. And so that's the backdrop for Mr. Lucky. And when he leaves this South American republic in the pilot, he brings with him his casino manager, who's played by Ross Martin. And the character's name is Andamo. And it's the two of them. And they have these various adventures. And the backdrop being this sort of gambling milieu, which attracts all kinds of shady characters and nice people. And so he's very different people every week.
Ross Martin was the co-star, John Vivian was the star, but John Vivian was not... I didn't know this until I read about it in Dreamsville. John Vivian was not the first person that Blake wanted to play Mr. Lucky. He wanted Ricardo Montalban.
Another revelation that I stumbled across.
He would have been perfect for that.
Exactly. But in 1959, according to Blake, either the network or the sponsor or both said no.
Yeah.
You can't have a Latino as the star of a network television show. Even though CBS had Desi Arnaz,
yeah,
who was a Cuban band leader in one of the most popular shows on television.
Although, and I read that, that made me scratch my head, but then I realized Desi was not an easy sell to CBS. I mean, Lucy had to lobby hard for CBS to approve.
And the network wanted Lucy.
Yeah. The network had Lucy because she was doing She was doing My Favorite Husband
on radio.
CBS Radio.
Yeah, that's so right. But the possibility of a Ricardo Montalban, a Mexican-born network star, would have been groundbreaking.
Yeah.
If they'd let it happen, but they didn't. They nixed it, and so he had to let go of the notion of Ricardo Montalban and found John Vivian, who had been playing mostly heavies in westerns at that point. But he was a handsome guy, and he's really good in the part.
Yeah.
I really enjoy the show.
That's one of the things that makes the backstory of Mr. Lucky fun to talk about. But wait till you hear what happens next. John Burlingame in the studio with us. John's latest book, Dreamsville, Henry Mancini, Peter Gunn, and Music for TV Noir. Everything you want to know about the backstory of Peter Gunn and Mr. Lucky. Take a quick time out. We'll talk some more with John Burlingame. We come back on TV Confidential. Be part of our conversation. If you like what you hear, have thoughts on this week's program, or have an idea for a future edition of TV Confidential, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at talk@tvconfidential.net, talk@tvconfidential.net. You can also message us at facebook.com/TV Confidential, x.com/TV Confidential, or at TV Confidential on Instagram. And if you're listening to us on the TV Confidential podcast, please be sure to hit the subscribe button.
This portion of TV Confidential is brought to us by our friends at Front Porch Realty, the community of realtors in the Northern Bay area of California that is committed to finding the solution that is best for their clients. Whether you're a first-time home buyer or looking to sell or lease your property in Northern California, call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 or visit frontporchrealtygroup.com for more information on how they can help you.